Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Today, I'd like to share with you another series of articles written by David McGowan, Why Everything You Think You Know About the Lincoln Assassination is Wrong. Head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, click on the Features tab, and scroll down to Lincoln, and feel free to join us at any time in this series. It is a 12-part series, and once again, every bit as entertaining as Wagging the Moondoggy. These will serve as an audio version for those that would like to listen while at work or on the road. So let's jump right in. Part one, why everything you think you know about the Lincoln assassination is wrong. And I will probably, from here out, replace the you with we, because I was certainly unaware of a lot of this information. And once again, Dave presents it in such a simple, down-to-earth, commonsensical way. So I really appreciate his research style, and I hope that you do too. So let's jump right in. Why everything we think we know about the Lincoln assassination is wrong. Part 1. In just a little over a year, in what will be an historic 150-year anniversary, the American people, and likely people all around the world, will come together in remembrance of the man who was once rather preposterously described by a biographer as, quote, the most gentle, most magnanimous, most Christ-like ruler of all time. That man, of course, was Abraham Lincoln, allegedly the 16th and most beloved president of these United States. I say allegedly here because it's hard to see how someone could be the president of an entity that didn't actually exist. And the reality is that during Lincoln's tenure, there was no such thing as the, quote, United States. There were northern states presided over by Washington, and there were Confederate states presided over by a parallel government in Richmond. But there certainly weren't any, quote, United States. Wouldn't it then be just as accurate to describe Jefferson Davis as the 16th president of the United States? Just checking. I also say allegedly here because Lincoln was most certainly not, during his lifetime, a beloved man. He was thoroughly despised throughout half the country and wasn't even all that popular in the North. He received merely 40% of the popular vote in 1860 and could have, as more honest historians have noted, been very easily defeated had the Democratic Party bothered to field a viable candidate. But Lincoln was clearly the anointed one. As we all know, Abraham Lincoln was assassinated by famed actor and Southern sympathizer John Wilkes Booth on the evening of April 14, 1865, which happened to be Good Friday, while attending a play at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. Just 5 days earlier, General Robert E. Lee had surrendered to General Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox, effectively signaling an end to the unfathomably bloody U.S. Civil War. What is less widely known is that the assassination of Lincoln was allegedly part of a larger plot that was to have included the simultaneous assassinations of General Grant, Vice President Andrew Johnson, Secretary of State William Seward, and Secretary of War Edwin Stanton. This alleged plot, which is part of the official history of the Lincoln assassination, obviously involved people other than John Wilkes Booth. Nine of these people faced trial as co-conspirators, eight by military tribunal: Mary Surratt, David Harold, George Azarote, Dr. Samuel Mudd, Samuel Arnold, Michael O'Loughlin, Edward Spengler, and Lewis Payne, P-A-I-N-E, or Lewis Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, or Lewis Powell, depending on who was telling the tale, and one who later stood trial alone, John Surratt. Four were executed, three received life sentences, one was given a 6-year prison term, and one was acquitted. As for Booth, he was captured and gunned down at Garrett's barn on April 26, 1865, and so never made it to trial. And that, in a nutshell, is the official narrative of the Lincoln assassination. It is an unusual narrative, to be sure, because it explicitly acknowledges a conspiracy surrounding the death of a president. Of course, many of the details are usually left out when the story is told, leading many to think of John Wilkes Booth as just another lone nut assassin. But Booth was hardly a lone nut, and there was, in fact, a conspiracy at the heart of the Lincoln assassination, though the people targeted by the government were not the real conspirators. The real conspirators were the very people who orchestrated the witch hunt against the scapegoats. But before we get to that, let's first skip ahead and look at some of the forgotten aftermath of the assassination, because there's always much to be learned by examining the fates that befall those involved to varying degrees in political conspiracies, especially those unfortunate souls whose names are largely consigned to the dustbins of history. So let's begin with Sergeant Thomas Boston Corbett, the Jack Ruby of the Lincoln assassination. Corbett was a strange character if there ever was one. How strange, you ask? Strange enough to have reportedly castrated himself circa 1858, and then he opted not to seek medical attention until he had tended to other, apparently more important, business. He was widely considered to be mentally unbalanced, shockingly enough, and he often spoke of hearing disembodied voices. He was mockingly referred to by his fellow soldiers as the Glory to God man, due to his rather unorthodox religious beliefs, which he wasn't shy about sharing. Due to his bizarre behavior and his unwillingness or inability to follow orders, Corbett had been court-martialed and discharged from the service. For some explained reason, though, he was allowed to re-enlist in 1863, and he quickly thereafter rose to the rank of sergeant. In April 1865, he was assigned to the elite team that captured Booth, and in defiance of direct orders, he personally shot and killed the man who was said to be Booth. Corbett was never reprimanded or disciplined for his actions, and in fact profited handsomely by touring the country for years as, quote, the man who killed Booth. In 1887, Corbett was appointed to the clerk doorman of the Kansas State Legislature. Things didn't go so well for him after that. According to some reports, one day he just decided to shoot the place up, though other accounts hold that he didn't fire his weapon, but merely brandished it and issued threats. Whatever the case, he quickly found himself committed to a mental asylum. He managed to escape soon enough, though, and may have briefly surfaced in Texas before never being seen or heard from again. Let's next turn our attention to Major Henry Rathbone and Clara Harris, the couple who were sharing the presidential box at Ford's Theater with Abe and Mary Lincoln. At the time, Rathbone was dating Harris, who was both Rathbone's stepsister and the daughter of U.S. Senator Ira Harris. Rathbone was reportedly deeply cut when he attempted to disarm and detain Booth, who escaped by leaping over the railing and onto the stage. Rathbone later married Harris, and the two started a family and moved to Germany, where Rathbone served as U.S. consul to Hanover. Things didn't work out so well, though, for the Rathbones. In December 1883, Henry tried to kill his children and, when thwarted in that effort, instead shot and brutally carved up his wife Clara before turning the knife on himself. Like Corbett, he was sent off to a mental asylum. But unlike Corbett, Henry Rathbone spent the rest of his life there. Since I mentioned Mary Todd Lincoln just a couple of paragraphs ago, I should probably mention that she also ended up in an insane asylum. Always a bit on the crazy side, Mary became considerably crazier after the assassination, exhibiting increasingly erratic behavior and suffering from vivid hallucinations. She was ultimately committed by her own son, Robert Todd Lincoln. To say that Robert Lincoln had some rather unusual aspects to his life story would be quite an understatement. To begin with, we could note that he had the distinction of being the only man in history with direct links to three presidential assassinations. Just 21 when his father was gunned down, he subsequently was present at the assassinations of James Garfield in 1881 and William McKinley in 1901. He was also the only Lincoln son to survive his childhood. Brother Eddie died at age 3 in 1850, brother Willie at age 11 in 1862, and brother Tad barely made it to age 18 before dying in 1871. According to Robert Lincoln's own account, he was involved in a truly bizarre incident in late 1864, early 1865, not long before the death of his father. The younger Lincoln was saved from serious injury and possible death when he was pulled to safety by a stranger during a mishap on a train platform. That stranger just happened to be Edwin Booth, an older brother of John Wilkes Booth. Lincoln later maintained a long-term friendship and possible romance with Lucy Hale, the daughter of U.S. Senator John Hale, and a former paramour and fiancé of John Wilkes Booth. Small world, I guess. Speaking of Edwin Booth, on June 9, 1893, just as his casket was being carried for burial, he had died just 2 days earlier, Ford's Theater mysteriously collapsed, killing 22 people and injuring another 68. The building had been converted into a government record storage facility, and some of the records of the assassination were lost in the wreckage. Edwin and John's sister, Rosa Lee Booth, died under mysterious circumstances in January of 1880. Rumors at the time spoke of a mysterious assailant. Edwin Booth Clark, a son of Sister Asia Booth, and therefore a nephew of John Wilkes Booth, attended Annapolis and became a U.S. naval officer, but he thereafter disappeared at sea. Officially, he committed suicide by jumping overboard, and Junius Brutus Booth, the patriarch of the Booth clan, is said to have gone insane. U.S. Senator Preston King, credited with being one of the guys who supposedly prevented a mercy petition on behalf of Mary Surratt from reaching President Andrew Johnson, decided on November 12, 1865, to go swimming in New York with a bag of bullets tied around his neck. Officially, his death was a very innovative suicide. U.S. Senator James Lane, the other guy credited with supposedly preventing the mercy petition on behalf of Surratt from reaching Johnson, shot himself in the head while jumping from a carriage in Leavenworth, Kansas, on July 1, 1866. Or else he slit his own throat, whichever sounds better. U.S. Senator John Conness, a likely conspirator and a pallbearer at Lincoln's funeral, was committed to an insane asylum, where he later died. There was a lot of that sort of thing going around in those days. The body of William Peterson, the owner of the boarding house where Lincoln was taken immediately after being shot and where he died the next morning, was found on the grounds of the Smithsonian, loaded with the drug laudanum. His death, needless to say, was ruled a suicide. Colonel William Browning, who was Vice President Andrew Johnson's personal secretary, as well as being a personal friend to John Wilkes Booth, Browning claimed that Johnson was close to Booth as well, is believed to have been murdered, though details are sketchy. Less sketchy were the murders of Frank Boyle and William Watson, both of whom had the misfortune of physically resembling John Wilkes Booth. Both of their bodies were turned over to the War Department by overzealous vigilantes for the reward that was being offered. Stanton's department covered up the murders by unceremoniously disposing of the bodies, one of which was dumped into the Potomac River. Frances Adeline Seward and Frances Adeline Fanny Seward had the misfortune of bearing witness to the staged attack on William Seward, sitting Secretary of State, the husband of Frances, and the father of Fanny. Frances died of a reported heart attack on June 21, 1865, the summer solstice, just 2 months after the assassination of Lincoln and the alleged attempt on her husband's life. Fanny died the next year, on October 29, 1866, just before Halloween. She was just 21. The cause of her death remains unknown. A few years later, in 1870, William Seward legally adopted his young companion, Olive Risley, as his daughter. Risley was 26 at the time, and Seward was 69. Lafayette Baker was undoubtedly one of the central conspirators involved in the Lincoln assassination. As Honest Abe's spymaster and head of the NDP, a forerunner of the U.S. Secret Service, Baker had instituted a reign of terror, just as he had previously done as a member of San Francisco's Vigilance Committee, running roughshod over the U.S. Constitution. Under Baker's and Stanton's tyrannical watch, there were 260,000 dubious arrests made and some 38,000 people held without trial as political prisoners. Baker also introduced such innovations as midnight raids, forced entry without warrants, imprisonment without bail, and summary arrests. Around 1867, Baker published a book revealing the existence of what was said to be Booth's suppressed diary. He subsequently barricaded himself in his home and told friends that a secret cabal was intent on killing him. Press reports from December 1867 through February 1868 tell of repeated attempts made on his life. He was shot at twice, stabbed on his own front porch, and beaten by three or four men who attempted to abduct him. Nevertheless, when he turned up dead on July 3, 1868, the cause of death was said to be meningitis, necessitating an immediate sealed burial. A later exhumation, though, indicated that the cause of death was actually arsenic poisoning. Baker left behind cryptic notes alluding to a conspiracy behind the Lincoln assassination involving 11 members of Congress, 12 U.S. Army officers, 3 U.S. Navy officers, 1 governor, 5 bankers, 3 nationally known newspaper men, and 11 wealthy industrialists. Police officer John F. Parker had the dubious distinction of being the guy who was supposed to be guarding Lincoln at the time of the assassination, except that he instead opted to wander over next door to get good and drunk. Parker had a seriously checkered history with the department, having been written up on multiple occasions for conduct on becoming an officer, and the use of insolent language, visiting a house of prostitution, inappropriately discharging his weapon, sleeping on duty, and being drunk on duty. He was, nevertheless, assigned the task of guarding the president, a development that historians have been unable to explain. And he was assigned that task just in time to be neglecting his duties when Lincoln was shot. Parker was never reprimanded in any way for abandoning his post and leaving the president vulnerable. In fact, he was returned to duty at the White House, an honor usually reserved for senior officers with unblemished records. He was released from duty, though, in 1868, just after Stanton relinquished his post as Secretary of War. Parker was never seen or heard from again, and it's believed that he was either killed or went into hiding to avoid being killed. Next up is Edwin Stanton, Lincoln's Secretary of War and a seriously deranged individual. Prior to his emergence on the national scene, Stanton's greatest claim to fame was securing an acquittal for U.S. Representative Daniel Sickles on murder charges. On February 27, 1859, Sickles had gunned down the unarmed Philip Barton Key, U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia and the son of famed composer Francis Scott Key. Stanton argued a temporary insanity defense for the first time in U.S. history. The media, apparently every bit as corrupt in those days as it is today, overwhelmingly supported Sickles while vilifying both Key and Sickles' wife, who had reportedly been having an affair. Though standing trial for a capital offense, Sickles was allowed to stay in his jailer's apartment, have unlimited visitors, and, most amazingly, retain his weapon. As already stated, Sickles was acquitted and was subsequently allowed to retain his seat in the House of Representatives. He later became a Civil War general and the U.S. minister to Spain. Elsewhere in Stanton's biography, we find that at various times in his life, he personally ordered the exhumation of at least 2 bodies, one of them being his daughter Lucy, who was dug up circa 1842. According to reports, Stanton kept his daughter's decomposing corpse in a special container in his home for at least a year. Nothing there that would cause anyone to question his fitness to serve as Secretary of War. Stanton became a national figure when he was appointed by President Buchanan to serve as Attorney General on December 20, 1860, just weeks before Lincoln took office. He went on to wield considerable power in both the Lincoln and Johnson administrations. Indeed, Johnson's attempted dismissal of Stanton led directly to the impeachment proceedings begun against him. Stanton's reign came to an end, though, on December 24, 1869, when he turned up dead of unstated causes, though some reports allude to suicide, just as his brother had reportedly done in 1846. He had been nominated for a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court by President Grant and confirmed by the U.S. Senate before he died, just before he could take that seat. That's a whole lot of tragedy to befall a lot of people who were in a position to know more about the Lincoln assassination than they should have. There was at least one guy, though, who saw his fortunes rise. Major General Lew Wallace was a member of the hopelessly corrupt military tribunal that sat in judgment of Mary Surratt and others. In 1880, he became far better known as a writer of historical fiction when he wrote and published Ben-Hur, the best-selling novel of the 19th century. Well, over 100 years later, it is still in print. And he has pictures of all these things, guys. That's the end of part one. Head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, hit the Features tab, scroll down to Lincoln, and feel free to pick up with us in part two. Thank you for joining me. As always, look forward to catching you next time. Take care. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Today, we're going to pick back up in Why Everything We Think We Know About the Lincoln Assassination Is Wrong by David McGowan. Head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, hit the Features tab, scroll down to Lincoln, and feel free to pick up with us in part two. So let's jump right in. I know what you must be thinking here. How could you leave Francis Tumulty out of the previous post? Compared to him, guys like Boston, Corbett, Henry Rathbone, and Edwin Stanton seem perfectly sane. And whose name was in the news in a weirder way in the years following the assassination than the esteemed Dr. Francis Tumulty? And in addition, doesn't he deserve honorable mention for the ridiculous facial hair alone? I can't really argue much with any of that. I think it was probably a subconscious omission so that I would have something really good to start this post off with. Because as stories go, the Francis Tumulty story is pretty good, and seriously strange. But before getting into that, I must also quickly add Father Wiget to the list. W-I-G-E-T. Not much can be dug up on him, other than he was assigned as Mary Surratt's spiritual advisor during the brief period that she sat in her cell waiting to be executed, and he died shortly thereafter. Moving on now to the man of the hour, Francis Tumulty was arrested on May 5, 1865, on suspicion of being complicit in the plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. Tumulty was an associate of, and by some reports, a sometime employer of, executed conspirator David Harold, and that's H-E-R-O-L-D. His arrest was ordered by Secretary of War Edwin Stanton. To be fair to Tumulty, though, it should be noted that he was only one of some 2,000 people who were arrested as possible conspirators. That's how things work in a democracy, you see. Falsely imprisoned first, ask questions later. In any event, Tumulty was held for nearly a month before being released on May 30, 1865. Prior to his arrest, he had lived a very colorful life. Born around 1833 and raised in New York, Tumulty was widely viewed as a charlatan and a kook. While still a minor, he reportedly peddled pornographic materials. He soon transformed into a quack Indian herb doctor who was run out of various parts of the country for running cons. In one reported case, he was directly involved in the death of a, quote, patient, though he suffered no repercussions for his actions. According to one account, he kept a collection of human uteruses on display in his Washington, D.C. home. Some 23 years after his arrest in Washington, Tumulty took up lodging in, of all places, a boarding house in London's Whitechapel district, and has been identified by various researchers since that time as being a prime suspect in the still-unsolved Jack the Ripper murders. Following an arrest in November 7, 1888 for gross indecency, Tumulty fled the country on November 20 under an assumed name and quickly made his way back to the U.S., where he died some 5 years later. What are the odds, one wonders, that the very same guy would be suspected of involvement in two such completely different and seemingly unconnected crimes? Two crimes separated by a vast ocean and the passage of nearly 2.5 decades. Probably about the same odds that a guy like John Phillips would have connections to both the Black Dahlia murder and the Manson bloodbath. By the way, really quickly, those interested in learning more about the Black Dahlia murders, that's a lady who was killed in Los Angeles, I think in the 40s or 50s. If you're interested in that crime at all, check out the work of Steve Hodel, H-O-D-E-L. He believes that his father was the murderer. I mean, not only that, but the Zodiac murderer as well. Check out Steve Hodel, Black Dahlia murder. You'll find it very interesting. Moving on. Pictured below is the single-shot Derringer that, according to the legend we all know so well, John Wilkes Booth used to assassinate President Abraham Lincoln. One of the most iconic pieces of historical memorabilia that the country has to offer, it has been displayed for decades, viewed by millions, and written about by thousands. But after the passage of 149 years, it doesn't appear that anyone has ever thought to question why Booth, an intelligent and educated man by all accounts, would choose such a ridiculous weapon to take with him on his mission. Let's imagine that it's the evening of April 14, 1865, and you're John Wilkes Booth. Your mission is to assassinate the president in a crowded theater in the middle of Washington, which at the time is heavily fortified and militarized, because there is, you know, a war going on. And the enemy's base of operations in Richmond, Virginia, is only 100 miles away.